So we will, of course, devote some time to the theological meaning of the geography and all that as we go along, but that's not going to be our main thing. If there are questions that come up in your mind along that line that I don't bring up, why, please do that too. Now, maybe just a couple other things we could talk about first as to why this accent on the world of the Bible is in a way especially important with the Old Testament. I think in principle it's the same with the New Testament. But if you stop to think, the New Testament covers, you know, at the most something like 100 years, only a century, while the Old Testament, you know, depending on how you count, covers at least 2,000 years of at least regular history, you know, where we can at least, you know, go at it like we do other history, not to speak, of course, of the earlier part of the Old Testament. And I think involved here is also a, you know, what is really the difference between the Old and the New Testaments? Now you can answer that question, of course, in many ways. I think a lot of people misunderstand that word old, of course, as meaning antique, you know, old-fashioned, out of date, and hence, you know, why bother with the Old Testament unless you're interested in dusty old things like that. Or a common answer, particularly among liberals, is that the Old Testament was somehow a lower stage of religion. You know, it's sort of an evolutionary idea, that there they had more primitive ideas about God and about sin, about everything else. And obviously, again, no conservative is going to give that kind of answer. The Old Testament is every bit as much a part of our Bible as the New Testament is. Yet I wonder sometimes if in practice, even with people who would never admit that, you know, kind of think that way anyway, that's old, so, you know, why bother with it so much? So what really is the difference? Again, you can say that a lot of ways, but I think for our purposes, one can stress that one of the major differences between Old and New Testament is that the Old Testament was, the Old Testament church, if you will, was both church and state, while the New Testament church is church. And of course, separation of church and state, we make quite a point of that. That is, it's not basically a difference in their faith, or in their theology, or anything. It's not a difference in the value between the two testaments, or how much they're inspired, or how much they're God's word, or anything like that. But the old Israel, in contrast to the new Israel, and we often call the church the new Israel, the heir of the old Israel, this was both church and state. And to say state, of course, is to say politics. It was a political unit. It was in the midst of all the politics of the ancient Near East, of Assyria and Babylonia and Egypt, and you just can't study what's going on without knowing a little bit of that political situation. The Old Testament's language is geared to that audience that was in that situation, and so talks about theological things often in terms of politics, in terms of David, of David's house, of David's relations to other countries, and all those kinds of things, so that to get at the theology, to be able to translate that into how it is Christian meaning for us, how it applies to us where the church is no longer state, one has to, you know something about the state there. And that's true of geography too, what we want to spend time on tonight. Of course, this is very valuable for New Testament. Jesus, of course, if you will, traipsed all over the Holy Land and in the course of his ministry. But still, a lot of Jesus' sermons are we're not told the place, or, you know, there are large blocks of material that are in one place. There's a certain sense in which much of the Old Testament, just because it has to do with politics and wars and that type of thing, that the physical geography where it took place is much more necessary to understand its meaning in a certain sense than is true of the New Testament. If you think of the role that the temple played in the Old Testament, this was something, you know, external, but yet theologically the temple is very important to the Old Testament. And with the new, Christ, you know, speaks of himself as the fulfillment of the temple. His own body is the temple. Remember when his enemies finally got him, it was, you know, because they chose to not to try to understand what he meant when he said to destroy this this temple, and in 3 days I'll raise it up again. And with the sacrifices and all the rest. And of course, if you stop and think of the role that historical events play in the Old Testament, this is obvious once you say it. Okay, I don't have much more to say along this line. We want to look at the geography right away. But just to remind what you know, what you stop and think of it, the importance of historical events in the Old Testament, the Exodus, Abraham's journeys, Moses, David, and all the rest. And I suppose we should talk about the importance in prophecy too, or the role that prophecies of the land play in the Old Testament. Of course, to Abraham already, you know, that his descendants will have the land. It's, bound up with the messianic prophecy there. And after the Babylonian exile, the prophets spend a lot of time prophesying the return to the land. And, of course, they talk about the details of the land very often. And, of course, what does that mean, theologically for the Christian reader today? You know, there are Christians, of course, who want to understand that as still prophesying Jews will return to their land. That's why some Christians are very excited about, of course, modern Israel, that that's supposed to be a fulfillment of prophecy. And of course, we don't believe that at all. That's one of the big differences even among some conservatives. But the importance of the prophecy of the land, of course, we understand this is fulfilled again in Christ, in his body, and in the church, which we often describe as the body of Christ, today. And so finally, to talk that way, I think that that does remind us that even for the Christian, we shouldn't think of our world, our faith, as just something spiritual in the sense of having to do only with our minds, only with our heads, only with our feelings. You know, it has something to do with our bodies, with the whole world. This is part of the claim that the gospel has, and the Old Testament plays a role of reminding us of the fact that finally the gospel speaks to all of existence, and that faith, is finally a matter of our whole being, not just of our minds and the like. Of course, one way of stressing that is with the resurrection of the body. Of course, finally, we don't speak of just immortality in some general sense, but of course, the specifically resurrection of the body and a new creation, and so on. Well, I that's all I want to say along this line, a just general introduction as to what we want to do with the course and why I think it's of a little importance, and I hope you'll agree after you've been subjected to it. Maybe you have a little question or discussion on this part before we look at the geography proper. Okay, now if you look at this sheet that I gave you, on the first side, I have certain things in Palestine, and on the last side, certain things in the. I'm sorry, you didn't get one. Please protest. Let's see. There was also the sheet to be signed. Where you signed that already? Okay, fine. Sorry. If you look at what we have here on the first side, you will notice that cities are listed first there, often just one name, sometimes with a different name given when they had a different name at later times in New Testament times. Then mountains, we'll look at some of these later on. Number C maybe requires a little comment. I have rivers, and I have in parentheses after that the word wadi. This is not a word that I think is commonly known. It happens to be an Arabic word, and we use that word a lot because we don't readily have a word just like that in English. A river, we tend to think of something that carries water all year round. And Palestine, that's part of its geography. It doesn't rain all summer, basically from about the end of March till the end of September. There's no rain at all. And that means that nearly all of the riverbeds in Palestine are dry during that period. So Wadi is the Arabic name for that kind of a dry riverbed. If you've been out west, well, of course, we have names for it. There is the Spanish word arroyo that means the same thing, but if you I don't know Spanish or haven't lived in New Mexico. That doesn't communicate either. So we usually just stick with Wadi. And most of these rivers, if you look on maps, and that's what I'm concerned with here, will often give both names, or discussions of them will give both names. It'll give both the name of this river or Wadi in the biblical name, and often it'll give the modern name, Wadi this or Wadi that. And so at least for using maps, at least for knowing what they're talking about, I think some of these are worth noting. But Jordan, of course, is big enough and famous enough that the modern name is used today. But the Kishon River, which happens to be the little river that runs here along the northern edge of Mount Carmel, is one of those. The Arab name for that is the Wadi Mukatta. And on a lot of maps or discussions, you'll have both names or just one name. So I just want to describe what that means. If you allow me, maybe one personal comment on that number six. The river Zered, or the Wadi Hessa, an Arab name, is the, it's really off this map. It flows into the Dead Sea at the south end of the Dead Sea. It's the southernmost of these three main rivers on the east side of the Jordan River. In the King James translation, the Hebrew word here is translated brook, the brook Zered. And you know, when you read a brook, what do you think about? You know, a little babbling stream, not much, something you maybe could almost jump over. Well, my personal experience, the first time we were in Palestine, we were traveling down to some sites south of here. And you can see a little bit from this map, these are immense canyons that one could compare to, you know, not quite the Grand Canyon, but they're massive things, and you have to drive right through them. And after traversing these two tremendous canyons, we just got to the bottom of this immense canyon on a wretched road when our car conked out. In the middle of nowhere, it was largely desert. So after, you know, nosing around a little bit, crawling under the car, eventually I, not knowing too much about cars, but I could soon figure out what was wrong, because my gas tank had a gaping hole in it. You know, I connected with a rock on the wretched road in the wrong way. I lost all my gas. Well, you know, so what should I do? I hiked down the road a little bit. It was just short of that brook, and it is just a brook at the bottom of the canyon. But, you know, when you just read in the Bible, the brook is there, and you get no idea of what a tremendous canyon this is. But fortunately, just short of the brook here, there was a Point 4 station. This was an American relief program, you may recall the name. All it amounted to was a tremendous pile of drums of gasoline, fortunately, and a couple of guards there, which they insisted that they had some type of putty or gum, whatever it was, that wasn't soluble in gasoline, that they gave me to patch up my gasoline tank temporarily, and gave me enough gas to climb out of the canyon, you know, to nearby town and get it repaired permanently. And they wouldn't take any money for it, but they said this came from American taxes to begin with, so I shouldn't have to pay for it again. And I wasn't about to quarrel with them on that point at all. So if you will permit the personal reminiscence, every time I, in the Bible, run across the brook Zered, I have various memories. Now, I think maybe on these zones and peoples, I'm not going to spend time tonight on the tribal claims of the 12 tribes. You can see that, of course, in the back of your Bibles a lot, and I won't talk about that unless you have questions. But I think maybe a good place to begin would be to talk about these six geographical zones of Palestine, because I think that's very important for understanding a lot of things. And if we take these six zones, we can move from west to east. And I think this relief map is very helpful, although I have another map up there with some of the other things on it. But I think right now this relief map is most helpful. The first zone moving from west to east is the coastal plain, which, as you can see, is broad and flat, and it gets wider. The distance from the ocean to the hills or the mountains is further as you go south. And, of course, the rainfall also becomes less as you go south, so that this increasingly begins to turn into desert. down here. As you go north, why, the mountains begin to move right next to the ocean. So that when you get up here in what today is Lebanon, the border with Lebanon today would come just about up here, about, of course, where the boundary was with the territory of the Phoenicians of Tyre and Sidon in Bible times. But as you get up there, why, the mountains come almost down to the sea, and there's almost no coastal plain whatsoever there. The major break, of course, is Mount Carmel, which juts out into the ocean here. And, of course, mentioned a lot in the Bible, Elijah's famous encounter, of course, with the priests of Baal up there, and a lot of other mentions. Yeah.
Isn't it odd that God told Abraham this is the land of the elk and honey?
Yeah. Yeah, that's often commented on. You know, that's a little bit a matter of viewpoint, what's milk and honey. And I think the usual explanation is that those words are used especially with respect to people who are living out in the desert, where compared to the relative desert that they were in, where there was water or the possibility of pasture for their cattle only around a few oases, and the rest just nothing. Why, from that standpoint, this really was a land of milk and honey. Now, you know, maybe if you're going to compare it to the breadbasket of mid-America or something like that, why, you might not use those words, but, you know, that wasn't in the picture there at all. And that's still true today. To the north, you have largely mountains, where there's no possibility of much cultivation on any large scale. And to the south, you have, and east, you have deserts. So in one sense, in the, you know, where they were, there were not many other places that would match with Palestine in terms of agricultural possibilities and so on. So I think if you look at it from their perspective, why, that makes sense. Because today, again, you know, of course, the Arabs often, that a lot of this go to seed, so to speak. But the Israelis, with proper conservation practices and with irrigation and so on, why, much of this is, of course, as lush farm ground as you can imagine. Particularly this plain today is largely given to citrus groves, oranges especially. I don't know, for someone like you, if you didn't grow up in California, when you're there at that time of the year when they're blossoming, odor of the orange trees to drive through those orange groves at that time is almost intoxicating. You really do think of milk and honey, particularly at that time. But of course, many other things are growing there too. Well, now, Mount Carmel here should be mentioned. One thing you can see, this coastline explains some of why the Israelites of the Old Testament were not seafaring people. They had hardly any natural harbors. Up here is about the only one. And today, of course, you have Haifa there. In ancient times, you had the city of Akko, or Ptolemais in New Testament times, at the upper end of that bay. There was sort of a natural harbor. Of course, the modern Israelis, with heavy equipment, of course, are building, you know, breakwaters of their own, making their own harbors, but that wasn't available in ancient times. It was only the Phoenicians further up, where there are many natural indentations in the coastline, who, remember, were the seafaring people of that time, and the Lebanese today are the traders, or they were before the war. So much of that continues. Now, the trade routes, the natural trade routes of antiquity, to a large extent naturally came along this plain, because, of course, that was easy travel. But usually they were going from Egypt down here to Babylon or the like, over in that direction. So they had to cut over to the east at some point. And nearly always the route went, of course, along here from Egypt. And at this point about, they cut inland through this pass. You can see the indentation there. The Pass of Megiddo, which is not mentioned a lot in the Bible, but we know was historically very important. And many battles were fought there in Bible times and before and after at this pass. It was, of course, a natural place to try to head off the enemy. In fact, it's so important, you may recall that the Bible even uses this as a picture of the final showdown battle at the end, at the end of the world. And the book of Revelation talks about, usually with an Armageddon, it's spelled, and R is just mountain. And I think you can see Mageddon is really the same word as Megiddo, it's just a little bit different spelling. But that this name is used of a final cataclysm at the end of time sort of indicates the importance of this in Bible time. Well, usually the trade route crossed the pass here, and then usually followed this little indentation down to the Jordan Valley, and then went various points, either went up here to Damascus, or sometimes it went along the sea up here and crossed over here and went into to Damascus. So, but basically, Megiddo here we should know. The
you can see from that why the northern part of the Sea of Galilee was it was in the trade route from the east to that valley. That
Yeah, sure. And well, I can comment on it now. Part of this, you can see how Judah in the south, Jerusalem, partly why it stayed more faithful to God, why it was more conservative, if you will, was because the trade route stayed further away from it. They stayed away from it a little bit more naturally, and you can see the mountains were a little bit higher there. So for double reasons, they were more isolated. As long as they, you know, paid their taxes, why the other countries left them alone. While Israel to the north, and particularly Galilee, you know, was just inevitably much more exposed to things, much more tempted to join in with whatever was going on. And that undoubtedly accounts, that the geography here accounts for an awful lot of the what we know of Bible history. Something else to note. You remember that when Joshua invaded Palestine, apparently they swept all the way to the sea momentarily. And there are tribal claims that go that far. But apparently they didn't hold this territory very long. Apparently only a few years, depending on dates, after they came in. Why, some other people came down from the north and pushed them out of this territory. And these, of course, are the people who are often mentioned in the Bible, namely the Philistines. The Philistines, who settled especially in this area down here, although related peoples were further north. And they basically stayed there throughout the Old Testament period. It's a rather ironic thing that's often commented on today, that at least until the Seven-Day War in 1967, the modern Israelis occupied or were centered in almost exactly the part of Palestine where their ancestors were not. It was almost the reverse. In Bible times, the Israelites were basically clustered in the hills, in the mountains, and the coastal plain, even if they controlled it politically, it was not, you know, their own center. Another interesting thing we should note, has it ever been pointed out to you that this name Palestine, which is our common word for this whole area, comes from Philistine? If you stop and think, you can hear the similarity of those names. They both start with a P and so on, and an L. How'd that ever happen? That we know them by the name of those that the Bible, you know, considered the mortal enemies of the Israelites. Well, this happened. This didn't happen until New Testament times. Of course, remember the Old Testament name for all of this was Canaan. Remember, in 70 A.D., Jerusalem was destroyed by the Romans after the Jews revolted, and there was still another revolt a few years later. About 135 A.D., and by that time the Romans were so fed up with these Jews, you know, and revolting all the time and giving them such a rough time that, of course, they not only, you know, destroyed Jerusalem and the whole countryside, but they banished the Jews on pain of death from even coming back, you know, to the area of Jerusalem for a long time. But as sort of the final rubbing of salt into their wounds, why the Romans named this territory then after the Jews' major enemies. And remember, the Romans held on to it, you know, for a long enough time after that, as long as the Roman Empire lasted, that it sort of stuck in all of Western history And so today we have this very strange circumstance that we sort of know it by, in effect, Philistia, although it's just changed enough in Palestine that we don't easily know of the similarity. Maybe a comment now on the northernmost part of this coastal plain that's often considered a separate part of it, the plain of Sharon. And this is mentioned a number of times in the Bible, in the Song of Solomon, among other places, is an especially beautiful place. It was largely swamped until the modern Israelis, with modern equipment, drained it for the first time. But, you know, beautiful flowers do grow in swamps. But for economically and agriculturally, it was not very important until modern times, and that's why, other than just being mentioned in passing, it doesn't play much of a role in the Bible. I talked about this pass here before. You really have two rivers, one that flows from here into the Mediterranean, and another that flows to the east into the Jordan Valley. But for all practical purposes, that means that you've got a sort of a diagonal cut all the way across to the hills here. So naturally, this was always a very important factor there, not only for the trade routes that I talked about, but remember, for example, the kings of Israel, whose winter palace was at Samaria up in the hills. I mean, their summer palace was up in the hills where it was relatively cool. In the winter, that got too cold, so they tended to have a winter palace down in the valley here that was, you know, just above sea level and considerably warmer in the winter, named Jezreel. Remember Naboth's vineyard, that story is set there, and a lot of mentions of Jezreel just about there. Sometimes this is even called the Valley of Jezreel. Although this part up here, at least the geography is usually referred to as the Valley of Esdraelon. These names are used a little bit loosely. Sometimes Esdraelon is used of all of them. Sometimes Esdraelon is just the west half and Jezreel the east, but the two are used together to a large extent. And then begins Galilee, of course. And you can see southern Galilee is hilly, but not terribly mountainous. But the northern part of Galilee really gets mountainous. It's pretty comparable to the Alleghenies or the Appalachians in the eastern part of the United States. Well, I think that's all I want to say about the coastal plain here, basically. So to move on to the second zone now, moving to the to the east, the second zone we today would commonly call foothills. It's the beginning of the mountains. It's not really mountains yet, but you know it gradually changes from the flat plain to the higher hills. There is a technical name for these foothills that at least the geographies will often use that maybe is worth mentioning, and the name is the Shephelah or Shephelah. It's pronounced in different ways. This just happens to be the Hebrew word, really, for lowlands. It was low by comparison with the higher mountains where most of the Israelites lived. That's why they called it lowlands. And as I said before, these are very important in the south. In the north, where the mountains never get so high, why, of course, there isn't as much of a transitional zone, and there wasn't that much protection from the invaders as there is to the south. But in the south, these lowlands, these foothills, play a sort of a buffer role throughout history and tend to protect, as I said, the people of Judah, of the southern kingdom from other influences. Particularly in the time of the Philistines, remember. The Samson stories, as how repeatedly, if you check out the names of the cities that are mentioned there with Delilah and all the rest, why, it's a matter of Samson living in the upper foothills and finding the Philistine girls somehow more attractive than the Israelite ones, and then going down the rivers to just a little bit further to the beginning of the coastal plain and getting in these various escapades down there that you would call. But I think the Samson stories well illustrate the role that, to one degree or another, they played nearly all the time. The most of these streams that run into the Mediterranean here, most of them start right at the crest here. In fact, one of them starts in the western environs of Jerusalem. And in fact, the modern railroad, of course, from Jerusalem to Tel Aviv naturally follows that. But these cut very deeply right away. These are tremendous canyons, and I think even more than this map shows, are very beautiful, but both ideal for guerrilla warfare, but also very good for fighting off invaders, because in such canyons, with high ground all around, of course, it was relatively easy to keep invaders out. Well, then the third zone is this central mountain ridge, whatever you want to call it, which really is the homeland of the Israelites in the Bible. It's the center of gravity. And the main cities that play an important role in biblical history, that at least were their own cities, are nearly all, pretty well along this central ridge. It fades away as you get south, as it begins to, remember the traditional names for the northern and the southern boundaries of the Holy Land were from Dan up here at one of the major sources of the Jordan River, from Dan to Beersheba. The Bible uses that phrase a lot as sort of the general names. Beersheba is sort of the borderline for any possible agriculture. South of that, even today, at the Bedouin, the nomads who live there, they plant a small grain, but they plan on getting a crop only once every 3-4 years. It's a little bit feast or famine, but they're perfectly aware that normally you can't live by that. But by Beersheba, by this central hill country, is pretty well disappeared. And it's broken, of course, by the plain of Esdraelon up here, and starts again in a broader fashion to the north in Galilee. In height, the average, one could say, is about 2,000 feet, 800 meters, more or less, if you're moving to the metric system. That's about the elevation of Jerusalem. It's a little bit higher just north of Jerusalem, and it's a little bit higher just south. Hebron is probably 500 feet or so higher, but roughly around 2,000 feet. Maybe that doesn't sound like an awful lot, but if you are in Palestine, particularly in the summertime, and move from the hot, humid coastal plain and drive up to Jerusalem in a matter of an hour, you'll really appreciate that extra 2,000 feet. That makes a lot of difference. And every afternoon around 4 o'clock in the summer, if the cool breeze sweeps in off the ocean, it doesn't cool the coastal plain nearly as much as it cools the highlands of Jerusalem. That's when all the shutters, of course, are opened around 4 o'clock and so on. And by about 9 or 10, it's cool enough that you want a good blanket when you go to bed. In Jerusalem and throughout this coastal area, in the summer particularly, the temperature range is very predictable, with only minor variations, with a high roughly each afternoon of around 85 and a low of about 65. So it never gets really hot in Jerusalem, or I shouldn't say never, but relatively rarely. And it's just cool enough, so it's good sleeping at night. Jerusalem's a nice place. In the winter, of course, it's a little cooler, maybe again an average of 20 degrees cooler, maximums and minimums, but still not really cold. Jerusalem does have snow once every 3-4 years. Usually, of course, it melts about as soon as it falls. Snow isn't unknown, but not really a factor. Yeah.
Are those mountains similar to the Appalachian, all wooded?
Well, yeah.
Or are they bare?
Well, in Bible times, they probably were, particularly in the early Bible times. But with a combination of poor, forestation practices and the devastations of war and so on, they gradually got deforested over the centuries, so that until very recently, they were almost completely bare. And today, there's quite a contrast. On the Arab side, still, there's been hardly any replanting, partly because they're just a little more backward in general, but also because many of the, at least the uneducated Arabs, have the superstition that jinn, that is devils, live in trees. And so, you know, why ask for trouble? You know, why plant trees? I never could figure out. Somehow they make an exception for olive and fig trees, you know, fruit trees. Somehow devils don't like them. There are plenty of those around, but, you know, the oaks and the evergreens and so on, all of that, hardly any. That's changing gradually. But on the Israel side, where they, you know, probably most of the secular Jews don't believe in devils of any sort to begin with, well, they have no such concerns. And then they have a pretty strong reforestation program. And there are many areas there where it must look very similar to what it did in Bible times. In the north, particularly Galilee, and on up until you get to the high mountains of Lebanon up here, it's more covered with scrub. Stuff, you know, that at most is 4 or 5 feet high.
When we normally think of a mountain, we think of, like out west, bare mountains mostly. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, right. They should be compared more with the eastern mountains, right? Only up here, really, do you get anything that would be at all comparable to our western mountains. Well, now, so the and today the main road, you know, pretty well follows this spine, but I think you can see how even today with a car, it's not an easy trip because these valleys from both directions, you know, come right up to the spine so that you're always, you know, cutting down into canyons and the laborious driving, of course, that means. And in biblical times, all the more so, this was always a factor that made for isolation of one part of the country from another, made cooperation difficult. Remember, even at the time of the conquest under Joshua and the time of the judges, you know, many bitter complaints about how one tribe wouldn't help another when they had problems. They were perfectly content to stay in their own little area and the like. And that probably has something to do with the division between the north and the south, the division of the kingdoms too. But that, even in modern times, is somewhat of a factor that's very much divided. The main cities, of course, here, Jerusalem, of course, about right here, Bethlehem a little bit south, then Hebron. Those are the main ones in the south. I remember David got his start after hiding out, of course, playing guerrilla for quite a while in the foothills there. And, of course, Beersheba that I mentioned down there. Going to the north, remember the line between Israel and Judah ran just a few miles north of Jerusalem. So north in later Israel, of course, is Bethel, which was a shrine city where one of the golden calves was set up just a few miles north. Maybe I should mention Saul's capital initially was at Gibeah, not Gibeon, but Gibeah, which is only a short distance north of Jerusalem. And as an indication of the way things go all over the world today, Gibeah is, you know, fast being swallowed up by Jerusalem suburbs. Of course, in Bible times, well, I was, you know, well out. But then there's Gibeah. Gibeon is not far away. Bethel, Ai, they're all, you know, basically on this spine, maybe a mile or so off in either direction, but, you know, basically right along that road. Shiloh is a little bit further north. They're not on this map. The major city that should be mentioned here is Shechem up here, or Shechem, whatever pronunciation you like, which was also a capital of the northern kingdom for a long time. I know I'm tempted to say too much about that city because I spent 2 summers of my life on archaeological excavations up there. But you can see its strategic importance. It doesn't show up on this map, but here this main road goes between 2 mountains. There's a pass as it goes further north down up to Samaria and on up. But, of course, this pass was, again, another place of strategic importance and a lot of battles there. Remember, Shechem up here was the place where Jesus met the Samaritan woman at the Jacob's well. And the tomb of Jacob, or at least what they tell you is the tomb of Jacob, of course, is still to be found there, and so on. Those 2 mountains are maybe worth mentioning. Anyone know their names of the 2 mountains in between which Shechem sits? Mount Ebal and then Gerizim. Anyone recall some of the role that they play in Bible times? It's mentioned in Deuteronomy and mentioned again in the book of Joshua. And some scholars even think that, that it didn't happen just once, but that it happened quite regularly, that there were ceremonies of covenant renewal, of something like what I compare with renewal of one's confirmation vows that the Israelites had up there. And they had the ceremony of half of the congregation sitting on the lower slopes of one mountain, pronouncing curses if they, you know, were unfaithful and disobedient, and the other half sitting on the lower slopes of the opposite mountain and reading or pronouncing the corresponding blessings if they were faithful. And for Deuteronomy 27 and 28, the whole chapters are made up of the contents of those blessings and cursings, and it's mentioned other places. And as I say, some scholars think that may well have gone on regularly. That's a little bit speculative, but it's possible. But if you're up there, why, it's a very picturesque kind of an idea, and you can see how that would work out. Mount Gerizim, of course, later on was the sacred mountain of the Samaritans, their competition with Jerusalem. Remember, the woman asked Jesus, you know, shall we worship God here or in Jerusalem? She was looking for a fight, you know, and remember, Jesus kind of, you know, defused that question, didn't answer it the way in which I think she expected it to be. And of course, the ruins of that Samaritan temple are just there. In fact, it was uncovered for the first time while I was in that area. In fact, I won't tell you too many of my own personal experiences, but a few Samaritans still live in Shechem, in that area where their ancestors lived. A small community of only some 400 or 500 people today, but they still celebrate the Passover regularly every year on top of Mount Gerizim. It's the only place in the biblical world where you can still see a sacrifice going on, at least according to biblical prescriptions. And we happened to be in Palestine once at that Passover time and were able to be on top of Mount Gerizim at the ceremony. It is, you know, something that is worth seeing. It should be on film or something, so that it's, although that's such a rowdy outfit, that'd be quite a job to do too, but that's another story. Well, let's see. And then, of course, up into Galilee, where, of course, that whole situation breaks down. Galilee doesn't play that much of a role in Bible times. Well, the fourth zone, then, is this Jordan Rift, which, if you know the whole map, remember, it really starts much further north off this map, up into modern Lebanon. If you have followed the fighting in Lebanon, today at all, it extends on up there. I guess this map shows it a little bit on up into there. Chile, Syria, Hollow Syria is the modern name for that. It's the same type of depression further north. And of course, it extends much further south, even into parts of East Africa. So the basic fault extends over a very wide area. And as I think you know, a good share of what concerns us is below sea level. The Dead Sea, which is some 1,300 feet below sea level on its surface, and its deepest parts is a good 1,300 feet further, so it's quite a deep business there, except for the southern end, that's extremely shallow. And even the Sea of Galilee is a little better than 900 feet below sea level, so that's still, you know, quite low and warm in the wintertime. Of course, in the summertime, why, most of the Jordan Valley is a furnace. Nobody in his right mind stays there any longer than he has to. It doesn't even cool off at night. But in the wintertime, why, it's very nice. And of course, the Israelis are really capitalizing that, of course, for winter crops. I think I should comment on this little lake that shows on nearly all maps. The waters of Merom, sometimes it's called, it goes by various names, Lake Hula, H-U-L-E-H. I know the first time we were in Israel, we were driving up there and looking for it, and it is not there anymore. It's one thing where the Israelis have simply changed the map. It never was much more than a swamp, and the Israelis have drained it, and of course have some extremely fertile farmland as a result.